I dreamt a dream
Hello, my name is Kate Mildenhall. I'm a writer and co-host of the First Time podcast, and I am thrilled to be your host for this podcast series for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival. It's called I Didn't Plan It That Way, and it's conversations about failed ideas, misguided moments, and the books that stayed in the bottom drawer. Over five episodes, I'll talk to five guests of the festival: Meg Mason, Rick Morton, Sally Hepworth, Jesse Tu, and Michael Veitch, about their greatest failures and whether or not they learned anything from them at all. Do join myself, my guests, and the fabulous lineup of writers and thinkers for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival in Warburton this July 16 to 18. Check out our show notes or search for Yarra Valley Writers Festival for tickets.
Lowlands away, my John.
Sally Hepworth is the New York Times bestselling author of six novels, most recently The Good Sister, which was an instant bestseller. Her novel, The Mother-in-Law, has been optioned for a TV series by Hollywood actress and producer Amy Poehler, which I'm so jealous about. I can't even... Anyway, we'll carry on. Sally has lived around the world and previously worked in event management and human resources. She's basically released a book a year since she wrote her first while on maternity leave in 2014. Her novels are available worldwide in English and have been translated into 20 languages. She's got a huge presence on social media where she both regularly reads out her one-star reviews, which we are going to discuss, gives writing advice, and wears a variety of excellent knits, as shown today, which no one can see on the podcast, but it is excellent. Sally lives in Melbourne, Australia, with her husband and her three children, and it's such a pleasure to speak to you today, Sally.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. I'm so glad that we are able to connect, and I, as I've told you many times, I'm a huge fan of yours as well.
Let me begin, and just putting it out there, it's quite ironic that we're discussing today a series called I Didn't Plan It That Way, because you and I are talking on the last day of the first part of lockdown 4.0 in Melbourne. We're about to go into lockdown for another 7 days. We both have small children and work from home. How are you going, Sally?
I mean, it's not how we planned it, is it? But look, I feel like I am coping okay. You know, I hear stories about people who are really doing it tough, you know, single parents, people who have businesses that have been affected by COVID. And not that it's a race or a kind of competition to who has it worse, but I kind of feel like we're just keeping our heads down and muddling through. And in the end, we're kind of feeling quite lucky that, in the sense, we haven't been terribly affected. It's just a little bit of time at home, and that's what we've been saying to the kids, and Christian and I have been saying it. Not that we've got it together in any way, shape, or
right.
form.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I need to hear from other people who, you know, maybe got on the wine a bit too much in the first couple of days. You know, maybe haven't managed to not yell at the kids.
Let's just say that as we speak, my two older children are sitting out on the couch watching a movie, each with a can of Pepsi Max, because that was
awesome.
And it's just after 12, but that was how I managed to convince them to not interrupt me in this podcast while Christian went to collect Clementine from kinder. So we're doing what we have to do. We're not in our best parenting scenario, not that I'm really ever there, but it's not terrible. We will survive it. And I think that we'll all be stronger people because of it.
We will. And we will all be celebrating at Yarra Valley Writers Festival in actual real life people, you know, by the end of July. I want to begin, Sally, by asking you if this was the plan for you. Was the dream to be a best-selling author when you grew up?
Yeah. When I grew up, it was not, only because I didn't really know that it was something that you could be. I mean, once I made the decision that I wanted to write a book and I started writing a book, yes, it was the dream. I always laugh when people say, you know, when you've had a success, did you ever dream of this? And you know, the answer, of course, is yes. All you do is dream of it when you're trying to do something. It doesn't necessarily mean that you believed that it would happen. But I certainly always dreamed of becoming published and you know, selling a lot of books. In terms of when I was a child and what I thought that I would do, hindsight is so wonderful, because now people say, oh, you were always good at writing, you were always writing things. My mum has managed to produce a couple of books that I wrote when I was very young, nice, as evidence that it was always in the stars. But no, I mean, did you? When I was younger and I thought, what do I want to do, even with the knowledge that I loved writing, wasn't like you could go to university and become a, you know, particularly creative writing. Like if it was journalism or something, yes, but writing.
No, it wasn't a real gig. It wasn't, you know, even if you had books on your shelves too, there wasn't a straight line or a direct line between yourself and who might actually write one of those. So,
yes, exactly. And it felt like something that only, I always say this, but old men did in a cabin by a lake on a typewriter with a bottle of whiskey. And if Google didn't exist, I would still not know how to do it. You know, that is when I decided I want to do this, I Googled how to write a book and then how to get a book published, because until Google existed, how did one know how that process worked? It was a bit of a, you know, just a something that mates knew, I guess, and told each other, or people passed on to each other in the industry. But now it's this big wide world that's available for people. And I often say to them, there is no special handshake. It's not who you know. I knew no one. I knew nothing. I had no ins into publishing. I just searched everything up myself and figured out how to do it and taught myself to write. And, you know, all the information's out there if you go and search for it.
I love your frankness in the way that you talk about that. And I think that is has been so incredible for emerging writers now, is that you've got a bunch of writers who get on podcasts or publish articles that say, this is exactly how I did it. These are the steps that I followed. This is the hack that I found here to work out how to do my plot, et cetera. I was listening to you on the fabulous podcast, 40, on the 40 podcast, and your no list. And people were so into it that you had to publish this list on Instagram so people can go and have a look. Can you just give us an example of some of the things that you now say no to, Sally, just to give the audience a bit of context?
The list is long. The top ones were, I don't go to any of my kids' school fundraisers or social events.
So good.
Thanks. And I, you know, that was a really good one to firm up, because I knew I didn't like going, but there was a moment where I said, no, that I don't do that. And it was just glorious. I don't go into the school grounds for any reason, if I can help it, you know. And I, again, I'm lucky because I have my husband is a stay-at-home dad, so he does enter the school grounds on occasion when it's required.
Amazing.
But not me. I don't have coffee with people during the week or have lunch with people. Again, it was funny, you were saying before, people, you know, you don't know that being a writer is a real job. And I feel like people still don't know it's a real job. And I could spend my whole life just going for coffee with people who want to find out how to be a writer. I just tell them to go Google it. Or people, you know, friends who want to catch up, or
because you're at home, you know, right? You're just at home thinking up of ideas.
Yeah, I'll just have some time to do that. So that's a no, except I make the exception for my great auntie Gwen, who's 94 and in a nursing home. I drop everything for her. But, you know, again, that's priorities. That's, you know, she's up the top. I say no to playing with my kids. I mean, isn't that the worst when they come up and they want to play a game?
They just want to play.
I mean, that's a no for me.
Sally, what I loved so much about it, and I did share it with a couple of friends, is that in thinking about our conversation today and about failures, I was thinking that so many of my own failures, or what I perceive to be my own failures, are about what other people think of me, you know, other people's perceptions and expectations, whether I, you know, offended someone or failed to live up to someone else's expectation. And I was recalling the moment in grade 5 when my favorite teacher when I had, and I was a very good girl in grade five, and I had been caught playing hits jailbreak on the top court. And she pulled me aside and she said, "I am very disappointed in you, Kate Mildenhall." And like, still rings in my ears, right? That kind of her perception of me. And so what I want to ask is, when and how did you stop caring so much about what other people think? And has it changed your outlook on failures and mistakes?
Okay, so I don't think I have changed or stopped caring about what people think, insofar as the things that matter to me. So I would hate the idea that someone thought that I was racist, you know, not a good ally to communities that I consider myself an ally to. If people thought that I was misrepresenting someone or misrepresenting myself, if I was inauthentic, there are lots of things that I care about deeply that I would hate to kind of,
that's interesting,
break that trust, I guess.
Sure.
Do I care if I don't, what people think about me not entering the school grounds? No, I don't care. In fact, I put it out there in the sense or for the reason to free people, because so many people have a list, you know, they just don't publish it.
Yeah.
And to know that other people say no to things, and everyone's list will be different, right? You know, some people love school functions and some people, you know, love, what else, you know, having coffee with friends, and they can make that work. But the idea that you're allowed to say no to things in your life, and just that's a no, and that's okay. We need to keep talking about that. Children feel like the holy grail of things that you can't disappoint. You know, you could put on there, "My no list includes drinking red wine," and people would go, "Oh, good for you." But if you say anything that might indicate that you are anything but the most devoted, loving, selfless mother, that's when that can rock people a little bit. And I feel strongly about the fact that children don't need you and shouldn't need you to be a martyr. That's not something I want to model to my children. I want them to see that mummy does say no. When they grow up and they go to work, they will have people that say no to them, that say, "This is my boundary, this is what I do and I don't do." The only thing that would really, something I care about, is whether my children feel loved. And that is something that I would hate to disappoint them on that.
But you write in your books about so much about women and women's lives, about motherhood, friendship, about relationships. Do you think that women are more inclined to see ourselves continually as failures?
Or
failing in aspects of our lives, sorry.
It certainly seems like it. And I'm constantly having to look at women in general and then myself and a lot of my friends, because I find myself often surprised, even when I did the interview 40, where I talked about the things I say no to and talked about being, you know, about failing. And I realized how much my friends and the world that we have, we're so comfortable with failure. We talk about it for sport and we laugh, you know, and because that, you know, failure is part of striving. And so do we consider ourselves a failure? I mean, my friends and I compete in the opposite way that most people compete about who's the kind of worst mother. Like we'll say, "Oh, my kids had, you know, McDonald's for dinner," and then someone else will say, "You fed your kids dinner. Well, my kids haven't eaten for 3 days." So that's my friend. Then there's women in general who I think, of course, we have to consider that, you know, the patriarchy has done something to us in terms of guilt, and I'm not immune to guilt, including parenting guilt, but I still think we have choice in it. And I think that's why boundaries is so appealing to women, and it's such a kind of buzzword at the moment, is because women identify that actually they need to be able to say no to things, that perhaps this guilt is bullshit that we're having, and perhaps we're having a little bit of a revolution as women to realize what we're capable of. And even the ones who aren't saying no yet are recognizing that perhaps there should be a no list in their future.
I want to talk about a juicy story that you have, because I know that you have a bottom drawer novel, and I'm really into this, and I don't know if you know this, but I also like to get quite involved in my research, and for the Mother Fault, I jumped on a yacht to sail from Darwin to Indonesia just to, you know, to get the feel of it. And I know that you also at times have gone quite deep into your research. Can you please, Sally Hepworth, tell us about the swingers party?
I wish I'd gone on a yacht. That would have been a much more fun experience, but perhaps not quite as interesting to retell at dinner parties. So, yes, after I wrote The Mother-in-Law, I came up with a new idea about a new idea for a book, which was about three couples that go to a swingers party. And obviously,
great when concept, hot,
right? I thought so, and they meet at the swingers party, and something goes terribly wrong, and then we kind of, it unfolds what happened at the swingers party. And of course, when I was writing the book, I was assuming that it would be published. You know, I had written five novels before it, and they had been published, and this one had been contracted. And so I jumped ahead a little bit to the publicity section, and I knew that I was going to be asked, how did you research, with a bit of a giggle. And I thought, because I love to shock people, it's just one of the great joys of my life, I thought, well, I have to go to a swingers party, right? I have to do this, you know, it'll bring authenticity to the book, but also going to make some good stories on the other side. And so I said to Christian, who is just I always describe him as being an accountant in every sense of the word. he's probably but very supportive. And I said to him, we have to go to a swingers party. And he was thinking I was joking for quite some time. But I then found us a party, and it was quite a high end.
I have to interrupt you. How did you find a party?
How do you find anything, Kate? Google.
On the Google, of course.
That's how I find my information. So I Googled it, and I found there is a series of parties, an organisation that runs these parties, that is run by this high society British woman who went to school with Kate Middleton. She started organising these parties in the English countryside that were kind of these eyes wide shut, you know, really glamorous sex parties. Mm-hmm. And they started there, and then they went all around the world, and they, you know, it's this really successful business. And so we looked it up and found that there was a party in Sydney. We're from Melbourne, and I thought, Sydney, that's good, because we're not going to see anyone we know, because can you imagine? And I don't know, there was something about just leaving, you know, the kids, mm-hmm. And whatnot to go. So we flew, we booked in. The process of booking in was kind of more in depth than you would think. You had to submit photographs. That was funny. I remember Christian and I sitting on the couch, you know, watching the boys and looking through the photos that we should submit. You had to be under 40. So it was a few years ago. So we just scraped through. You had to pay, I think it was about $500 a ticket to attend. You know, you had to do all these things and agree to a very long list of rules that the party follows. And
I mean, the rules themselves, there's a novel in that, right?
There really is. They should call it The Rules. Wait, there is a book called The Rules. But anyway, we got to Sydney. We got to the party. We only got the address 24 hours before via email. The whole thing, it felt very eyes wide shut. You went to the door, and then you had to give your name, and then you were taken up. And I mean, at this point, Christian and I wanted to vomit, you know, and it was so far out of our comfort zone. I'm someone who doesn't even really like leaving my house. And here I am, I'm in Sydney. It's a swingers party. It started.
What did you wear? What did you have to wear?
Well, the theme or the dress code was a cocktail, mm-hmm. with masquerade. So we purchased our masks from Spotlight. Mine had feathers, and Christian's was a Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. I mean, creepiest thing I've ever seen. And we, you know, I wore a little black dress, and
as you do,
I could have been going to a 40th. You know, it was not anything to worry about then. But we then got into the party. We read the list of rules. One was that you only women could approach men couldn't approach women. men and women could come as couples and single women, but not single men.
Mm-hmm.
If you were rejected by someone, or if you you know, proposed that someone come with you and they said no, you're not allowed to approach them again. There were just it was quite liberating in a way. I kind of thought to myself, wouldn't that be nice back in the day when we were at the pub and being bothered by someone? I would have liked a few rules then.
Absolutely.
But the party quite quickly got lively, and it was, I mean, the first thing, we went from sipping our champagne, and I think we were only about halfway through the first drink when the first orgy started.
What?
And I always say, it's not my thing, right? Like, I'm a bit of a nana. And you know, even back in my 20s, having sex with one man was exciting enough, you know, and these things, not my cup of tea. But if it was your thing, it was magnificent. I mean, the people were gorgeous and young in their 20s. They were wearing these sexy kind of lingerie, and it was amazing. But there were probably 12 people in this orgy. And
are you taking notes at this stage, Sally? Like, how's the author brain in you working at this point?
At first, I think that my brain, I was in that panic attack mode of trying mm-hmm. not to vomit in public, because I have that nervous vomiting thing. And Christian was then panicking that I was going to vomit. So we were both, you know, not looking like we fit in. And I remember I quickly went to the bathroom, because the bathroom was one of the only places where you could be alone. And I got it together and I came out, and then I just had my writer's brain on. So I was just paying attention to what was going on, the noises, because the interesting thing about the noises is that you had to continually ask for consent. And so, unlike if you're on a date or you're in the back of a car or you're whatnot and things are allowed to progress, you needed to, every new movement, every, you know, whether you're touching the breast and then the body, you know, had to be consented. So there's this constant talking. I mean, it was magnificent. And I had all of this up here, right? You know, I'm thinking this is going to be a great novel. And we'll talk about that in a second. But my favorite memory of the whole thing is Christian, who once I was okay, he had been dispatched to the bar just to drink, and he was happiest there. And he was quite good, because women were allowed to approach men, but men not women. Women were coming up to him, and he was doing research for me. He was saying, "What brings you here?" And then he would come back to me and he'd say, "That woman is bisexual. She's come with her partner because she wants to experience sex with women."
Yeah.
And go talk to her. And then this person. And so he was fantastic. God love him. And so it's a little unfair that a couple of hours later, I looked over at the bar and he was standing there with his beer, just head down, knocking them back. And this man came out of one of the bedrooms next to him wearing only a shirt and no pants. And at this point, a lot of the people were naked. Christian and I were the only people fully dressed. But this man, no pants, but a shirt like Tom Cruise in Risky Business, you know, but no socks.
Oh, God.
And I was looking at him next to Christian and I thought, I wonder if he's wearing undies. Like, what's going on under that shirt? And not batting an eye, because there were people having a threesome to my right. Like, it was really just in the side. Yeah. I wonder.
You were already, you know,
I was
used to this.
Yeah, I'd become acclimatized very quickly. It's shocking how that happens.
But of course.
Then the man turned and his giant boner hit Christian in the leg. And it's one of those things that I think about with such bizarre affection, that time that man's boner hit my husband in the leg.
Greater love hath no man for his writer partner.
I know. And so then, you know, we went away and I wrote the book. Christian needed therapy, although also felt a little bit like a hero, because everyone loved us after that. Everyone wanted to know what happened at the swingers party.
Absolutely.
Including
dine out for years.
Yes, because who hasn't wanted to know that? I mean, and even our both sets of parents knew that we were going. And I remember waking up in the morning and feeling dirty. And to be clear, anyone listening, we did not partake. And that was fine, because this was a big party, 80 people. And I had I had told the organizer that I was writing a book and I was not interested in partaking. And she said, this is the party to go to because it's big, so people won't notice if you're not taking part. And a lot of new people, first timers and things who don't take part will be there. So you won't be, you know, it won't be obvious. And next day, you know, phone overloaded with people wanting to know how it was. And so went away, I wrote the book. And I will say that the book did not come together in a glorious way for me. I had the premise and I obviously had the swingers party details. And there were bits about that book that I loved. You know, I really loved the kind of sinister atmosphere and the sexiness. Not that it was not erotic fiction. It was really a book about sex and marriage and you know, just framed around this swingers party. But I knew it wasn't working on some level, and that is not unusual for me. I often kind of take on an idea and then I send it to my publisher and they'll come back. And I am a writer who does lots of big rewrites. I didn't really realize until having a few author friends that almost every time I get rewrites back, they're big, you know, they're kind of kill that whole plot, don't work with that character, you know, big rewrites. And I thought that I was hoping that was what was going to happen with this one because I knew it needed help. I wasn't really aware that this was going to be a book that just couldn't be fixed. And at first, the first time I sent it to the publisher, she came back quite quickly and said, oh, Sally, I don't think this is working, but what if you tried this? And
okay. All right. So not a straight up no. Just a kind of let's shift this
but
part.
It wasn't good, Kate. I mean, it was, I haven't had that happen before. And the suggestion that she gave, I thought, I don't know. I don't know if that is going to work, but I was so lost in the book. And I find that that happens with some, often when I try and bite off more than I can chew, you kind of lose sight of what you were trying to do with the book and you kind of becomes this big kind of cumbersome, ugly beast that you can't control. And I felt like that. And the more I tried to fix it, the worse that it became until I just lost it. I didn't want to work on it anymore. But then came the next phone call from my publisher who said, she didn't say we won't publish it at any point, but she said, I really wish that you would start something new.
Wow.
And I remember it was, ironically, it was a year later, we're in Sydney when we got that information and we'd just been on a cruise. Christian has always wanted to go on a cruise and I have not wanted to go on a cruise. And so I agreed to go on this 3-day cruise from Melbourne to Sydney and we had arrived in Sydney and I'd been seasick the whole time and we were, it was a low time in my life, Kate. And I was sitting on this beach and I got the phone call and I hung up. And I said to Christian, they're not going to publish the book. And the first thing he said was, does that mean we went to a swingers party for nothing? and the second thing was, or was me saying to him, can we withstand this financially? Because at this point, Christian still worked, but I was the main breadwinner of the family. We had just built a house. We rely on my income. And this is a year, I'd spent a year writing this book where I was paying for childcare, you know, I was not getting the money that I was expecting to get and I was going to have to start again. And he said, I don't know. And in the end, we worked out that, you know, we probably could have just scraped through. It would have been, you know, a real setback. Thankfully, at that time, the mother-in-law had just come out and ended up selling quite well and sold the TV rights to Amy Poehler, as you mentioned. And in the end, that kind of saved us from what would have been, you know, I mean, not the end of the world, but a real big financial blow for us. And so it wasn't just the dealing with the emotional, creative crisis of having a book rejected, but it was the really real idea that we could lose our house. And so just a lot of rejection coming there. Funnily enough, at the same time as I was having this just wonderful success with the mother-in-law and everyone that was kind of looking on, if they were watching on social media or if they were you know, seeing the very real good things that were happening to me would have said, oh, she's flying. She's, you know, isn't, and people would say that to me, isn't she doing well? And at the same time, I was at the lowest kind of point creatively in my career.
Because did it rock your faith? I didn't realize that it was so far along in the process. I didn't realize this was, you know, book five. Mm-hmm. Did it kind of shake the foundations of your faith in yourself to be able to keep producing work?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, it wasn't that I've always been fairly pragmatic in terms of writing and also in my own ability. I never get lost in an idea that I'm really, really good at it or really, really bad at it. I think I have a good sense of where I sit. And so it's no big shock to me if someone doesn't like my book or if in this case, I was aware that it wasn't working. So it wasn't that I was blindsided by the fact that it didn't get published. I knew it wasn't working in some ways, but I also was terrified that on starting something new, I would A, have it rejected because I needed the money. You know, that's not very sexy to say, is that people don't like it when authors talk about money.
Yeah, but it's true.
We need money. I needed to have confidence that this was not the downward part of my trajectory and that was it, you know, and that I could handle a blip, both emotionally, creatively and financially, but I couldn't handle this. And so that was difficult.
In that, just on a practical level, because I know that a lot of writers will hear this and they'll be so grateful for your openness in talking about it. Immediately after, when you said, okay, this is it, we're not going to publish this one, I'm going to have to write something new, what did that space look like? Did you give yourself a break? Did you put the Swinger book completely away and say, I want nothing to do with any of these characters, ideas, et cetera? Or did you try and, you know, get something from the ashes of it? Creatively, I
initially, I suggested a different kind of swinging book, which probably makes me sound like a bit of a pervert.
Not at all. You had a great story to tell, you know.
I was just desperate to get this swinging book over the line. I remember asking my publisher, what if it was, you know, more of a 70s style keys in a bowl, you know, would that work? And she's like, Sally, no, you know, she's in New York.
Drop it, Sally.
I'm going to leave the swingers thing. Did I take a break? I mean, not really. A, because again, financially, I needed to write a book, but also I'm a full-time writer. And so there's only so much time that you know, what do? Yoga and you know, I'm here at my desk every day and my children are at school or in full-time care. So I don't have them here in business hours. This is my job. And so I very quickly started brainstorming new ideas. They didn't come straight away. And I have got so many little snippets of memories. One, when I had proposed a different idea to my publisher and she didn't like it. And I remember going for one of those soul searching walks around my neighborhood. And I remember sitting with my legs crossed in the middle of an oval that's just around the corner there on the phone to my agent who's in LA and sobbing. And I remember these old, sweet old couple with their dog walked past and I was on the phone going, like that kind of desperate heaving. But I feel emotions very hard and then I get over them quite fast. I'm a Gemini. And so I just needed to go through that grief. And then the moment that I came up with the new idea, which was for the Good Sister, as soon as I came up with it, I knew that it was a good one. You know, I thought this is, and I'd like to write this book and I think this is going to work. And I got the green light for that. And then I was back, you know, I had recovered. I was excited about this book, still nervous, still terrified that it wouldn't work. And my publishers and my agent worked with me. Jen, who has been my publisher at St. Martin's Press through all the books, she said, we're going to write this one together. She lied because she didn't write a single word of it. But she let me send it to her whenever I wanted. She would read it, you know, after a few chapters and then a few more chapters. And about halfway through, she said, you've got this, go and write it. And you know, it now, because isn't it wonderful to talk about your failures when you've had great success? You know, there's this healing that mm-hmm. comes. Not that I've had great success, but I mean, it's much, I don't know if I could have spoken to you about it at the time that I was sitting in the oval sobbing. now, you know, The Good Sister came out, it was a New York Times bestseller, it's had all of these wonderful things happen. And so I guess anyone who's listening, if they've been rejected and they feel like, shit, I can't be this candid, you will be able to. You just need to get eventually over that. Like when you get success again, you can kind of grapple with what happened. And that's kind of where I am now.
Have you and your publisher been able to, and, you know, the beauty of hindsight again, kind of nut out what it was specifically that was broken or that wasn't working in the Swingers book and incorporated that kind of knowledge into The Good Sister and whatever you're writing next? Like, have you learnt something from at a practical, technical level?
No, and no one could really put their finger on it, and I can't either,
yeah,
which is sort of scary, yeah, in the sense that, yeah, there's no learning that I can kind of take and say that's never going to happen to me again. Honestly, I think it will happen to me again. I think that my hope is to write books for the rest of my life, and I think that some of them aren't going to be any good.
You reckon that you'll know earlier? You reckon that you won't persist with something that where you've got that feeling like, oh, I'm not sure on this one?
Probably not.
Or just we just have to prepare for this. Shit, Sally, I don't know if I want to hear this. But good. I mean, truth telling. It's all about truth telling, right?
I don't know, Kate. Like, I don't know what the wisdom is. My current thought is some people, I talk about it a lot. Everyone loves the Swingers story because not only is it juicy, but people love learning from other people's failures as well. I know that I do, and I'm so happy to share that. But I don't know how to tell anyone how for that not to happen again. All I can, how for that not to happen to them, I don't know. I don't even know that it won't happen to me again. But what I can say is that when you get to the other side of it, it becomes one of those things that's in your story, a little bit like, I feel like when my first book came out and I stood up, you know, at the launch and things and talked about all the rejection that I'd had on the way to getting that published, and all of a sudden that becomes something that you look at a little bit more affectionately, I suppose, as one of the things that's just part of success. Failure is part of success. And if you're going to keep trying to do something, you have to accept that. That's why I accept that happened. I don't know why, and there will be more failure. That's a sure thing.
Your pragmatism is something that I think is so appealing, and I love your Writerly Wednesday sessions on Instagram, and people should go have a look at that. And I mentioned to you in our emails that you struck me as having that kind of Cheryl Strayed and Liz Gilbert both do it, I think. That pragmatism, which is very unromanticized about being a writer, that kind of says, I don't have time for the angstiness, yeah, of it, for the sitting, you know, for the pulling out my hair. It's work. I'm being paid to do this, and I need to do it. And I sent you her her piece, Write Like a Motherfucker, which I have pinned up on my wall, which is a response to this 29-year-old aspiring writer who feels like she's already failed, you know, at 29. And Strayed's response is basically, you're both up too high and you're down too low, yeah, and you can't work in that space. And I know that many writers reach out to you, and I wonder if some of the perceived failures are because people's expectations are just so high, like the expectation that you might not have a failed book even when you've got five bestsellers under your belt.
Yeah.
Are our expectations too high?
I think that there needs to be both low expectations. I mean, I said the other day on the 40 podcast, actually, that one of my philosophies for life, which I got from my mother, is have low expectations in general. And absolutely, that's the way to go. If you are planning to have a writing career, have low expectations. At the same time, I feel like I've sat on so many panels at writers' festivals or, you know, author events where I see all of these aspiring authors in the audience with stars in their eyes. And I know that authors want them not to have their hearts broken. And that's why you'll hear a lot of authors talking about how woeful the money is and how hard it is and all the rejection. But at the same time, I think it's really important to say to those authors as well that it is possible to find success too. And it isn't likely that it will happen to you, maybe, but it could happen to you. You know, you kind of, and that's where the highs and lows are true. Expect, you know, that it's probably, you're not going to be you know, Cheryl Strayed or, you know, whoever it is that you aspire to. But you've got to hope that you will be, because otherwise you can't kind of take that leap that is writing an author, that is writing a book that causes you to, you know, not go to things that you want to go to have the discipline to work before work and after work or while your baby sleeps or all of those things. And so I think in a way, yes, you have to get over yourself. Yes, you have to have humility. I loved that from that article. But you also do need to have, you need to know where you would love to be. And then you need to really pay attention to that person and how they got there and make it your job to work your ass off to try and be that person. You know, I do think that there is something in that. And if you're, just going in with the idea that it's going to be crap and I'm going to go through all this to earn no money and, you know, then we're not going to get the brilliant literary talent that we want.
That's so interesting, because I, as an absolute obsessive on writers' stories and their process, and it's basically why we started the podcast, just to watch, like, how exactly did you do what you did, you know? And I often tell other people who are like, well, how do you do social media? I'm like, go and follow all of these people and watch what they do. Literally just copy what they do or see what works for you. I think now, having spoken to you and heard your failure story, that there will be a lot of people who can put that in their back pocket and say, well, this is what happened to Sally Hepworth. But one of the questions I asked you in advance was, is there anyone that you've observed failing really well? And I know that you put this out on Instagram, and I want to know, did you get any corker responses?
Do you know, it stumped me, and that's why I put it on Instagram, because I thought, gosh, that's a worry, isn't it, that no one springs to mind of doing it well? What does that say? And then there were a couple of people that came to mind who also came through the Instagram results. And again, I'm not sure that they're the right kind of, I mean, let's talk about it. So one that I got was Monica Lewinsky. And I think that why that is interesting is that, of course, she has been able to have her second act, hasn't she, recently, as she's been speaking out about, you know, her experience.
Yes.
And I think one thing to learn from her is that one way to come back well is with vulnerability. That's a lesson that can be applied. But I don't love it, because it really indicates that she failed. And I don't really think that's the right way to brand what happened to her. I mean, you know, not that it's a complete, well, I just wouldn't call that a failure. Another one that, again, I mean, I don't really know is a failure, but I spend a lot of time watching Mia Friedman in her role. And so it's not about one specific failure as much as with someone like her that's been in the media for her whole career. She goes like this, you know, there are times when she's very, you know, controversial. Maybe it's something she's written or said. And there's no doubt, if you are spending that much time in the public eye, something you say will irk people. And I love,
absolutely,
I love how she every time will not disappear off social media like some people do and wait for the storm to blow over. She comes out and owns what she's done, tries to understand it better, and ultimately does better. And I think that's why she's continued to be in the public eye and be as successful as she is. So she's probably an example.
I like that.
Yeah. The other one that came through that on Instagram that I actually thought of, and again, terrible example, was Brendan Favola.
Oh, Bev.
Isn't that so funny?
Oh, mate.
Because there's no doubt that, again, like, he's having a second act, isn't he? But I feel like the only thing to learn from that is, I suppose, well, I guess he recovered from addiction, didn't he? And he's just a really kind of lovable guy. So I don't really know. And he's funny. I think being funny always helps, but there's not a lot of wisdom there. So let's stick with Mia Friedman.
I love it. And I also love the way that you've framed those as second act. Like, that's just a really powerful way of thinking about coming back from those blips and those low moments you've talked about too. I'm conscious I could talk to you for another 2 hours, and I'm very glad that we have the opportunity to speak on stage at Yarra Valley Writers Festival. But before I let you go, I have to ask you about your reading of your one-star reviews on Instagram, because honestly, you know, most writers, I would hazard a guess, can't even look at their Goodreads, let alone publicly read them out. So tell me, Sally, why do you do this, and what does it bring to your life?
It's just so funny, Kate. I mean, you've probably heard me reading them, but if you do a search of your reviews by one star, and I know that it's not something that people generally like to do, but you will find some of the best writing that you've ever seen. Like, these people, the adjectives and the, you know, that they can use to describe why they didn't like the book, and the phrasing that they come up with. And it is just so funny. You don't find that same verbiage on the 3-star reviews. Those ones are the ones that hurt me.
Yeah.
You know,
very middling.
Those measured reviews that are saying things like, well, you know, this part was good, but I really was disappointed by this. Those ones hurt more than the 1-stars, because I read them and think, shit, they're right. Yep, that's a fair, balanced review. Whereas the 1-stars are just wonderful to read, and they're funny, and they're, you know, and again, have low expectations. That's my way of going into it. So I don't expect everyone's going to like my book. And it doesn't hurt to see, unless it comes back to, if they had said something like they found something I had written racist, you know, or prejudiced, and I'm not saying that those things don't exist. I know that, you know, I try and do better with every book, but I may have unwittingly done something that offended someone. I would not read out that review, and I would try and do better. But there was one recently about The Family Next Door where the reviewer said they wished that all the women in the book would get thrown in the ocean and stung by jellyfish.
I mean, that is gold.
I'm friends with that
Oh
person.
My goodness.
That is a person who knows what they like, and I think that's got to be respected. So, look, I hope.
I feel like you will have to be the guest of honour at Writers Victoria runs a very delightful, they did it for the, I think it's only the second time they'll do it, Starry One Star Night at Buck Mulligan's, where you go and drink whiskey and writers are invited to get up and read out their 1-star reviews.
Oh.
And yes, very therapeutic kind of an exercise. I did do it. And it struck me that I did it before The Motherfolk came out. So I did it about my first book, and I was a long way, you know, I was 4 years out from it, and gosh, it was easy to do it then. Gosh, it was easy to laugh at them. But I would recommend that people not read them about maybe their most recent book, especially if they're a debut, because I think, though, you know, in those moments, you develop a tough skin the further along we go, I feel.
Oh, absolutely you do. And I often think that when people get in touch and say, gee, you're brave, my first thought is always, really? It doesn't feel brave, but you're absolutely right. I think that you do become, I don't know, like a weathered old prune with each book that you come out with. And it's surprising how hard it can be to upset me these days. But yeah, as I said, there are things that upset me, but not those 1-star reviews. They bring me joy.
Sally Hepworth, you are about as far from a weathered old prune as one could possibly be, but it's been such a delight to speak to you. I can't wait to speak to you at the festival about The Good Sister. And until then, please just keep collecting your 1-star reviews so we can talk about them more then.
Oh, I'll bring a few along and we can read them out.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you for having me. This was gorgeous.
Thank you, Kate. I'm Brooke Powell, Festival Director, and I'm so very pleased you joined us. This year's Yarra Valley Writers Festival is calling the township of Warburton its home over the weekend of July 16 to 18, 2021. There will be writerly sessions, walks in nature, and dinners in extraordinary rooms. We have also curated virtual sessions to be made available to those that can't make it to the beautiful Yarra Valley. We've done this as it's important to us that we stay in touch with all of you after such a strange and tumultuous time. The Yarra Valley Writers Festival thanks all of its supporters, its collaborators, and its friends that buy tickets. We need you, and we do love you. We also hope to share a long and story-filled life with all of you. With that, we pay respects to some of the greatest storytellers of all time, and we respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land. We pay respect to all Aboriginal community elders, past, present, and future, who have resided in the area and have been an integral part of the history of this region. If you're after tickets, more information on our program, or simply would like to send us an email, please head to our website, yarravalleywritersfestival.com.
Yarra Valley Writers Festival is funded by Creative Victoria and Yarra Rangers Tourism, supported by Yarra Rangers Council and Verso Books. The music accompanying this episode is Lowlands Away by Thomas Veitch and Rose Hampton from the Hellship soundtrack. Audio production by Phoebe Adie.